Hey, Randy, what's going on?
How you doing, Jim?
Well, I'm having a grand old time. This week, even though I told you that I have a tendency to get lost when triangles are concerned, you sent me into a big barrage of them. So I did go a little crazy trying to figure things out, but that's okay. I still haven't.
I was kind of glad to see that you put that work into that, because that actually helped me understand the rotation argument, one of the things we're going to talk about tonight, which is one of my favorite subjects of all time, gravitational field propulsion. And we're going to look at a whole host of ideas surrounding that idea. And one of them caught your imagination, so I'm really kind of thrilled about that. I sent you an animation of that idea, which is called Swimming in Space-Time. Did you get that?
I did not see the animation, no. One of the things I failed to do was to actually simulate what's going on in a curved space-time. So I wanted to look at something in a curved space-time to actually see if I could figure out what was going on and why that would work. I tried to do it first analytically, but you know, I want to get it to a point where I'm sure that I'm not putting whatever it is that I want to see into it. Because I can make math that shows that this thing's happening.
Well, once you see it visually, it's a lot easier to understand. So I'm going to send you a copy of that animation again. And if I can find the link to this animation, well, maybe we can drop that in the show notes. Because it's kind of hard to explain verbally. But once you see it, it'll seem really obvious.
No, you did send it to me. I didn't print it out because it's an AVI.
That's it.
In any event, you know, that's still not quite what I was getting at, is that, you know, with these things, I'd like to be absolutely sure that what I'm seeing is correct, because whenever you start getting into even special relativity, but general relativity in particular, there are a lot of ways that you can forget something, and all of a sudden you have a really cool thing going on that probably isn't really, really there. It can make life a little bit annoying.
We'll do our best to kind of describe that when we get into that section, and maybe the listeners will get a clear enough idea to visualize it. It seems fairly intuitive once it's explained and you can see what's going on, especially when you see the animation. And I looked online to see if I could find any rebuttals or any disproofs or any arguments against it, and I didn't. So it seems like people are pretty convinced that it's physically valid. It's just the scale of the effect is too small to experiment with in around the Earth's gravity field. It is an interesting one, and I love it because it's like one of those things that you're like, wow, you know, general relativity offers this as a possibility in the theoretical regime, but we didn't really anticipate it because it took a creative insight to realize that you could do that.
Yeah, at some point we have to actually talk about what it is.
But I wanted to start off with the simple stuff, because for most of this, gravitational field propulsion is very theoretical. And I figured we could start with just the simplest, most crude form of gravitational field propulsion, which is the gravity assist maneuver that NASA uses all the time.
Okay, well, why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, since 1973 with the Mariner 10 mission, NASA's been using planet orbiting around the sun in order to boost the speed of spacecraft or change the direction. You can even use it to brake. But the idea is simple. It's kind of like grabbing hold of a passing train to increase your own kinetic energy. So in this case, gravity acts as kind of the handle for a satellite to grab hold of, and then it picks up some of the speed that the passing planet will have so that it can gain energy and go to the outer planets without having to bring a whole bunch of rocket fuel aboard.
Yeah, so it's something that, I mean, I remember as an undergraduate that we did in our classical mechanics class. So it's not something that's strange. It's something that people do all the time, is just use the gravitation of a body to give something a little bit extra energy just by planning your trajectory correctly when you go into a gravitational well.
So it's just the simplest way to use a gravitational field to accelerate a spacecraft, and just to show that there's at least one way that we do that today. And we're just kind of getting started on the whole gravity field propulsion concepts, but that's sort of like the most Newtonian form that you can come up with. There was a couple other interesting topics that came up when I was looking at this. There was the Oberth effect, and this is when they let a spacecraft fall into the gravitational field of a planet and then fire their rockets when they're at their maximum speed, because apparently that's a great way to increase the kinetic energy transfer of your rocket, is when you're already moving fast and you kick on your propulsion at a high rate to accelerate out of the gravitational field. I don't know if they've done that. It's theoretically solid. And then there's a more speculative idea called the Penrose process, where you can steal kinetic energy from a rotating black hole by letting the spacecraft enter the ergosphere of the black hole and then releasing some matter into the black hole to sort of push itself out of the ergosphere, and it will escape with a higher velocity than it entered the black hole with.
Yeah, that's another thing. That was with a Kerr black hole, I believe. A rotating black hole. Actually, some of the things that you sent me, I didn't actually realize from when I had classes on this stuff.
You must be thinking of that Robert Forward paper, Space Warps, huh?
Yeah, that has nothing to do with this process, but I've just recalled the rotating black hole. I didn't recall that it was a rotating ring to set up that Kerr metric. If you have that Kerr metric, then you have a ring event horizon. That outer one's a ring, and you can pass something through it, and you can actually use a similar effect as you could from the gravitational well from your planet and actually get energy out of that black hole.
Yeah, I had never heard of that effect before until I was looking at that tonight, I guess because, you know, it's not really practical. People don't talk about it much, but Robert Forward did a really nice job talking about all the different kinds of black holes and their different layers of horizons that are on the different charged and rotating black holes in that wonderful paper, Space Warps. He writes really great papers. You know, he does a good job providing a very clear synopsis of physical ideas in a really concise manner. I really love reading his work. We're going to talk about one of his other papers soon, later in this program. And that also brought up the idea that shouldn't that also work with like a rotating neutron star? Because it's going to have a frame dragging effect. And wouldn't that also sort of pull along an object that passes through it in the correct direction?
Yeah, there might be something different happening because of the strangeness that happens with the local reference frame. I think you're getting something extra from that black hole, but you should be able to do things like that with any gravitational well.
So this is an idea that a lot of people hadn't heard of and that kind of caught your imagination was Swimming in Space-Time is a paper that came out in 2002 by MIT's Jack Wisdom. This is a really fascinating idea. The idea is that if a body changes its shape in the proper sequence, then it can use the curvature of the gravitational field, the curvature of space-time, to change position and rotate within the field. It's really odd to think of the gravitational field that we think of as being the force holding us to the planet as something that you could use to propel a vehicle, but he was able to show that through the correct series of deformations that you can do this. And I think that the easiest way to try to visualize this without looking at the animation is if you imagine that you've got a T-shaped object and there's masses on both ends of the top of the T and at the tail of the T. And if you push all of those masses out along their various axial lines on the T at the same time and then pull them back in, when the masses of the T at the top move out further, because of the curvature of the field, they end up in an area of a slightly less gravitational potential. And so when they're extended, the overall mass is, because those masses at the top are at a lower potential, and then they pull in the tail at the same time, that you end up with a situation where you're center of mass creeps upwards a little bit. And if you can do this maneuver many times per second, then you can move your vehicle upwards in the gravitational field. He also showed how you can rotate within a gravitational field. And in none of these cases do you create any momentum. There's no linear momentum when you're doing this within a gravitational field, so it's not violating conservation of momentum. And when you're rotating using a series of specific sequences with rotating objects, you can cause it to look like it's rotating. He said at one point that if you do it fast enough, you won't even be able to see that it's going through a cycle, but it would seem to be rotating right in front of you without having any angular momentum. Because as soon as it stops doing these deformations, the rotation would stop.
Yeah, these are just these cycles, right? And the issue is, it's important that these are a sequence of different shape changes. Basically, what you have to do is you have to have a non-commutative set of shape changes. So that if you were to do something like change the shape one way, then change it in a perpendicular direction, then do the opposite, bring the shape back in that first direction, then bring it back in the second direction, you come to a different state than if when you did the reverses, you did the reverse in the reverse order. So you expand in the X direction, then you expand in the Y direction, then you contract the Y, and then you contract in the X. That would still get you back to your original center of mass. But if you do things XY, XY, then you end up with a different position. And I think the example that they give classically for something that's non-commutative like that is with book. If you hold a book up, if you take a book, you rotate it in the direction directly in front of you, then you do the direction perpendicular to you so that it's rotating up towards you. And then you rotate it in that third direction, which would be around the z-axis, you'll end up with your book in a different situation than if you rotated it in that axis in front of you, rotate it in that z-direction, and then do it in that perpendicular direction. So if you flip the order of those rotations, the end orientation of your book changes. So these things have to be non-commutative. And that would not be true for these deformations in a flat space-time. Flat space-time, these operations and their inverses are commutative, and it doesn't matter what order that you do them in. With the rotations, with the book, that's a different story. And when you're in a curved space-time, again, it's a different story. And like I was saying to you, it all goes back to that riddle that most people already know. And if you don't, I won't spoil it for you, which is... I just spoiled it for you. But that's okay. Through the miracle of editing, I won't. And this will show up again at the end. So you have a bear. He walks 1 mile due south, turns 90 degrees, walks 1 mile due west, turns 90 degrees, walks 1 mile due north. And he's back at the point where he started. And the riddle is what color is the bear?
Yeah, I love that riddle.
And that riddle has the same idea as that on the surface of the earth, on this curved object, there are places where you have an equilateral triangle where at least two of those angles are 90 degrees. So it has more than...
180 degrees?
It has more than 180 degrees as the number of degrees in the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in flat space-time, it's only 180 degrees. That last one is not 90 degrees. So you can do this on this curved space-time, and in a curved space-time, if you go south on a curved object, west, north, and then if you go east again.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is. It's you go south, and then you go west, and then you go north, and you're back where you started.
That's right. But even if you're not at that very special place for the riddle, and you do that, you go 1 mile south, 1 mile west, 1 mile north, and then 1 mile east, you'll end up in a slightly different place than where you started. If you did all four of those things in that special place, it might be hard to do the fourth one. But those south, north, east, west are non-commutative on that curved surface. And it's something about that in that curved space-time that makes that actually possible.
Yep. The cool thing about this is that it's the space-time curvature around the Earth which is allowing it to manifest. So you can do it anywhere around the Earth. You know, you don't need to do it in any preferred position.
You sent me one that was Newtonian and had something to do with an orbit. It looked like he could do something very similar just by choosing the exact right spot to, say, turn a dumbbell that was in orbit. So if you had a dumbbell that was in orbit, I guess, if at the perigee you turn it perpendicular and then at the apogee you turn it parallel to the radius, you'll keep expanding the size of your orbit or the long axis of your orbit.
Yeah, that's a neat paper that was called Swimming in Newtonian Space-Time by Michael Longo, and that came out a couple years after Jack Wisdom's paper. And he explored that idea about changing the orientation of a dumbbell system using a gyroscope and making the masses on the dumbbell elongate or contract in a specific sequence as the body orbited the planet. And he came up with order of magnitude effects that were like 6,000 times greater than the swimming in space-time effect that Jack Wisdom had come up with for his paper. But he was looking at a different scenario too. He wasn't looking at like directly swimming away from a planet. I imagine they'd probably end up with the same results if they looked at the same scenario. But it was neat that he looked at that and he could see a way that maybe this is an idea that would allow us to change the bit of satellites without using any propellant.
Yeah, and that's definitely useful. That does bring something up, though. Definitely in the swimming in space-time paper, he was using a Schwarzschild metric, a non-rotating black hole. But the question I had about that is this effect larger than that black hole?
Oh, well, there was an article about the effect in, I don't know, Scientific American or something, where it said that if you were near a black hole, that you could possibly even swim away from the black hole as an astronaut just by throwing your arms out and pulling your legs in the correct sequence. So it's much more powerful effect in a really steep gravitational field gradient. But he did calculate it for around the Earth, and he said that going around the Earth in the Earth's gravitational field, if you had deformations on a scale of 1 meter, so if they're elongating and contracting by a distance of 1 meter, that each cycle could move you 10 to the minus 23rd meters. So you'd need an awful lot of...
You'd need an awful lot to move the size of a proton.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, you've got this swimming idea, and like you said, I thought that was fairly interesting. I'm not completely sure what to do with it, because it is a fairly small effect, but I mean, it is kind of interesting that this works. I'd like to understand the relativity well enough to be certain about it, but I don't. Like I said, I'd like to be able to, from first principles, write a computer program that showed something slowly moving up my computer screen. That's really the level that it'd have to be for me to really understand it. I know what he's saying is happening, but to really understand why that's happening, I think that's what I have to do.
Well, take a look at that animation. That might be a good starting point to just start getting your head around it, because it's a lot easier for me to understand it looking at that, too. And if I can find that link to the animation, I'll send it to you so you can put it in the show notes.
Well, like I said, I can do that in my head. I drew those out on a piece of paper to figure out what he's saying and what's happening. So I have a pretty good idea about what he says should be happening.
Right, you want to get it mathematically.
I want to make sure that I understand it. And the only way I think I can be completely sure that I understand it is to understand exactly what's happening. So this sort of triangular swimmer that they're talking about is basically a triangle. Well, it's not a triangle. It's basically the three vertices of a triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some constraints that are on that triangle. But you can't have all of the constraints that you would have on a Newtonian triangle as this thing's moving around. So some things are, I have to know which of these constraints are really the important constraints. And on top of that, I need to really understand how the internal forces are working against each other in this curved space-time. And that's the more complicated thing. That's really what I think I have to understand.
Yeah, I remember reading about it on, I think it was the Physics Stack Exchange, and people were talking about how in Newtonian physics, the center of mass is very well-defined. But in general relativity, it's not well-defined. So you've got the situation where you sort of have to calculate what the center of mass is doing as it undergoes these series of deformations to really understand what the hell is happening, you know?
Okay, now I think that's what they said in the Scientific American article. So I don't know what they mean by the center of mass not being well-defined. So it seems to me that if you have a metric and you know how to do integrals on that metric, and you know things like the mass density, then it shouldn't be too much of a problem. And actually, if you have something like this, it should be even less of a problem, because basically what you're saying is all the mass is concentrated at three points.
Yeah, but then those three points are changing their position at different points in a gravitational gradient.
But it's also mostly symmetric. So you can just say, okay, I've got this geodesic going out through the middle of my black hole or my gravity well, and then I'm looking at what's happening to either side a little bit farther up. So it shouldn't be that hard to figure out exactly what's going on. Now, I can see lots of things being more complicated. Triangles are really special. Well, I shouldn't say they're really special, but they are fairly special objects. Lots of nice simplified things happen with them, like the center of mass of a uniformly distributed mass in a triangle is the same as what's called the vertex centroid, which is basically the average of the positions of the three vertices, right? The center of mass is also the same if all the mass is concentrated on the edges, which would be the edge centroid. So all three of those positions are the same for the triangle. They're not all the same for a trapezoid, let's say. It still might be too symmetric. Probably for a trapezoid, they're not. Definitely not for a random quadrilateral. So what exactly you mean by the center of mass could be difficult. When we talk about the gravitational dipole moment later on, I'll talk a little bit more about some of the issues. So let's see. Now, probably the most fun paper that you sent me was Robert Forward's negative matter propulsion.
That is a fun one.
And I think in this one, what he does is he does something different from the negative gravitational charge thing that we were talking about previously, which is possible for antimatter. We don't really know. I don't think most people believe that it would happen with antimatter, but there's still the hope. For this stuff, this negative matter that he's talking about, what you have is both the inertial and the gravitational mass are negative. So that what happens is you're saying, well, if I had this stuff, then I could have a positive mass in front of a negative mass, and that negative mass would push the positive mass forward, and the positive mass would pull that negative mass along with it, and so they keep pushing and pulling each other and go off into space and be happy as a nice propulsive mechanism. And it turns out that that cannot be something that would happen with like antimatter or anything at all similar to any of the particles in the standard model. And Forward didn't give any reasons for that, but he said that can't be any of these things, because all of the things in the standard model have to have a normal sort of inertia, whereas this negative mass has a whacked out inertia.
Yeah, the word perverse comes up a few times, because you're talking about a form of matter that when you push it, it comes at you.
And on top of that, wasn't this the one where he showed that it doesn't matter whether it's being pushed by a negative mass or a positive mass, it still acts the same way?
Yeah, he says it doesn't matter how you couple together the positive and negative mass. You can couple it together with electrostatic or magnetic or a mechanical spring or with gravity. And in all of these cases, they will accelerate in the same direction without violating any conservation laws.
I think there was something interesting about that. Like the negative mass that has the negative inertia, no matter what, would push away from each other.
Well, from anything attractive.
Negative and negative still pushed away, just like positive and positive track. So like we said before, the positive one was pulling the negative mass, and the negative mass was pushing the positive one away. But if they were two negative masses, they'd both be pushing each other away.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. I guess that's because it's, I can't remember why that is, but
it's because it has that negative inertia. And so you have two negative signs when you're dealing with the force. You have one for the inertia, the MA, and one for the gravitation.
Oh, right. So they'd gravitationally attract, but because they're inverse inertia, they would be physically moving apart from each other.
That's right.
Wow, that's bizarre. It's so hard to get your head around that because it's just so outside of the realm of human intuition.
Yeah, and if you have problems with that, talk to Dr. Forward.
Yeah, I think he racked his brains on this one because he really seemed to enjoy delving into it. This is not even that new of an idea. He published that paper in 1990, but Hermann Bondi had come up with that idea as a valid concept within general relativity back in 1957 with a paper called Negative Mass in General Relativity. So this is an idea that's been around for a while, and I think I've read another paper that Forward had written where he talked about theoretical methods by which to collect negative mass if it was charged and that kind of thing. But we don't know if this is physically real or not, but the consequences if you could make something that had these effects would be really amazing. One of the things that he looked at as a possible physical explanation of cosmology was he looked at the idea that maybe those giant bubble-like cosmic voids between the galaxy clusters might be filled with this stuff. And he said that because negative mass repels itself and gravitationally positive matter, that might explain why galactic rotation curves are fairly flat, is that they're getting an extra push from the outside from these surrounding regions. That's an interesting idea. That could possibly even explain the dark energy effect, accelerating the whole cosmos apart. And he liked that idea because it would mean that the universe has equal positive and negative matter in it, so it's the ultimate free lunch.
Yeah. All you have to do is, you know, produce some of this stuff that doesn't like to interact with anything.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. I remember at one point, I wish I could remember the name of the paper where he talked about how you might be able to collect it if it exists in nature. It's almost disappointing that we've never run across anything like it because you look at these physical effects and they'd be so much fun to play with.
That's usually the case with things you can't actually find or create.
But there's no law in physics, he says, that we know of now that seems to prohibit it. Certainly, general relativity doesn't prohibit negative matter, but there may be something about quantum mechanics or maybe a unified field theory that would prohibit it. But so far, we're not really sure if it's physically achievable. The other thing he mentioned that kind of beggars the mind is the idea that you could create this stuff for free if you created equal amounts of positive and negative matter, because the net energy is still zero.
So that was a little odd. So, but we need some idea like that somewhere.
The next idea that we're going to talk about, do you want to jump on to the anomalous center of mass shift paper?
Okay, go ahead.
This one's by Yoo Jin Jong, a South Korean physicist, published in 1996. It's called Center of Mass Shift Gravitational Dipole Moment, where he looks at the physics of a simple hemisphere shell. So you've got a hemispherical shell, and you rotate it around its central axis. And the relativistic mass increase moves the center of mass upward as you rotate it faster and faster. Now, I think this is a gem, like an undiscovered gem, but maybe it's a piece of crap. I don't know. I mean, I've looked at it and it seems to make sense to me, but the implications are staggering. So I don't know. What did you think of this paper?
This one I was a little bit worried about. Part of it's me. Part of it's I'm not completely sure what's happening. Part of it's the whole thing that I was talking about earlier, that with this relativity stuff, you have to be pretty careful a lot of times. What he's saying makes sense in some fashion. I'm not sure if it makes total sense, but you would expect that if you had, say, a rotating object, that its apparent mass would be greater than if it wasn't rotating, because basically everything causes gravitation at some level. On the other hand, that's general relativity, not special relativity. when he's doing this, and I look at his integral, he's saying, okay, this thing's spinning. Now that's, it's spinning in, you know, the original reference frame where nothing's moving at all. So you have basically this sphere. It has two hemispheres. One gets to spin, the other doesn't get to spin. One stays somehow not spinning while the other one starts spinning. So this isn't one of these things that we really, really like, which is something is happening due to internal forces, right? This has to be from an external force. That thing starts spinning, its mass should in some way increase, right? Because it has that additional kinetic energy and all that sort of stuff going on. But when he's doing his integral to find the center of mass of the right-hand side, there is a little issue. And that issue is he doesn't seem to account for the Lorentz contraction. Now, I'm not sure if he has to in that integral, but I would think that he does because he's integrating around the direction that it's moving. So that differential element should be changing in size. So I would have thought he should have accounted for that Lorentz contraction, and that Lorentz contraction would actually completely balance out the effect that he's trying to say happens.
So you've got this hemisphere. It's spinning on its normal axis. The Lorentz contraction would just make the distance between points in the hemisphere get closer together relative to each other. They would still be the same distance radially from the axis, right?
Yeah, that's the thing that gets a little spooky.
Yeah.
That's still what probably should happen. So it's hard to say exactly what's going on, except from each point of view of each one of those elements, it stays the same. The guy on the other side is contracting even more than that guy is contracting in the original reference frame. It's not really that strange. It should be contracting. And we get to equally strange ideas when we start talking about all of the different metrics in general relativity. And that's the reason why I'm not completely sure what he should be seeing. But it does seem to me that the circumference of that circle, if you're not looking at it in its own rotating frame, should seem to be smaller.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is it seems like the circumference, and this seems really counterintuitive, but the circumference should get smaller because of the Lorentz contraction, but isn't the radius would still stay the same from the outside, wouldn't it? I mean, wouldn't the distance between the outside points still be the same from to an external observer? Because wouldn't the contraction only be along the circumferential direction, not radially?
Yeah, so that's sort of the weirdness, yeah. So the thing that's spinning should still be contracting, because that's where the velocity bit is. But, you know, there's nothing moving in the middle because it's a hollow sphere.
Right.
Why exactly it's doing that now?
Well, it would be contracting in the direction of motion, right? So, but the contraction would be along the circumferential direction.
Yeah, it would be around the circumference, which is sort of the issue, right? So, but on the other hand, that's also the place where you have to do the integral. So it makes it kind of hard to think that it could be anything otherwise.
I thought he was taking the integral from the axial direction and then of the masses in each plane, which would still be at the same distance they were when they at rest, right? Isn't that the important thing? So you can get your angular momentum and everything?
His integral for the change in the center of mass has to be on that spherical shell that's moving. That means that the r d theta element should actually be something like an r times the square root of 1 minus the ratio of the linear speed of that element to the speed of light squared times the angle element. So I'm not completely sure about that. I mean, even though he talked about it a little bit later, just thinking about it and what it's doing, you start wondering, well, doesn't this mean there has to be some sort of negative charge on the other side and stuff like that? And you also have some other issues with the interpretation later on where he starts talking about the gravitational dipole moment and it's being something that it can interact with the rest of the world. Because in special relativity, when you're doing these things, what you have to do is you have to look in the frame of the object when you're calculating the force. Right. So when you calculate the field generated from the object, you have to look in the frame of the object where it's not moving. And then when you're calculating the force on the object, you have to, again, go back to the frame where it's not moving to calculate the force. So you have to take whatever the field is and then transform it into the frame where it's not moving, which gets really, really nasty because if you have this thing that's rotating, then every different point is moving in a different frame because it's always accelerated. I would have very much liked to have found something on Thomas' precession to have a little bit better idea about what was going on with that mathematically to see what they did there. But my references didn't really give me as much of that as I thought. So I remember a lot about Thomas' precession from, you know, being an undergraduate, but I can't find it in books. It just happened to be a favorite of one of my professors.
Yeah, I can't help there. I can't remember the last time I looked at Thomas' precession.
Now, he also said that this might touch on an experiment from 1989. Do you know anything about that experiment?
Which one are you talking about?
The Hayasaka Takeuchi.
Oh, crap. No, but that sounds like that was a rotating cylinder, which is interesting because that reminds me of another physicist who did some work with rotating cylinders and said that he was able to detect some kind of time dilation effect above it.
With this thing, it shouldn't matter. If you had two rotating cylinders instead of two rotating hemispheres, it should still do the same thing. If what he was doing was correct, in fact, if what he was doing was correct, the math should be easier for the rotating cylinders.
Yeah, but with a rotating cylinder, you're not going to get a center of mass shift, are you?
No, you still should get a center of mass shift. Why wouldn't you get a center of mass shift?
With a rotating cylinder?
Yeah, why not?
Because it's symmetrical.
So you're saying that because it's symmetrical all along that line, that rotation doesn't do anything interesting?
Yeah, that's what I assumed.
That might be true, because it would all be the same velocity.
Right.
You'd still end up with a larger mass, right, on that right-hand side.
That's true.
So you still should get a center of mass shift if everything is fine.
No, I'm not sure what you mean by the right-hand side. Should I be looking?
Yeah, I'm looking at my drawings from my notes.
Oh, okay.
So that doesn't help anybody. Yeah. So you've got the two hemispheres, right? The left-hand side and the right-hand side. The right-hand side is the one that, you know, I decide is the one that's going to spin on the spinning side.
Okay.
So the mass increase is just going to be the inertial mass divided by 1 minus omega r over c squared. And that omega r over c squared is the ratio of the velocity at any given point on the mass, on the thing that's spinning, to the speed of light. So that would be true in either case. And it seems to me that if you're looking at a rotating center of mass shift, that would be easier to calculate for lots of different reasons. One is that the center of that thing that's spinning on the right-hand side, that center is at a nice easy place, which is half the size of the cylinder. Right. And then on top of that, when you're doing your integral to figure out what the actual mass is as it's spinning, that denominator isn't changing. So that change of the center of mass is going to be just directly related to that gamma factor, that 1 over the square root of 1 minus the square of the ratio of the speed to the speed of light squared.
Yeah, but I thought that this idea was dependent on the fact that the spinning hemisphere, when it's in motion, its center of mass is going to move closer to the equator of the hemisphere. But a cylinder undergoing rotation is going to have the same center of mass whether it's spinning or not, right? Because the stationary cylinder isn't part of the system that's spinning, so I don't see how they're equivalent.
Yeah, I'm not completely sure what you mean by that. Okay, so let's see. No, I'm looking at this, and I've just done it. If the thing's just sitting there, right, nothing's spinning, right?
And you're talking about which one now?
The cylinders.
Okay.
Then nothing's spinning, everything should go to zero, right? Because either side has the same mass. But if you have one of them spinning, you've got an excess of mass on one side. The center of mass of either one of those cylinders doesn't change. So you have on one side of your equation the difference between the masses of those two things. And one's larger because it has that kinetic energy. And all of that multiplied by half the length of one of the cylinders. Then you divide that by the total mass, which is a number, which is greater than twice the original mass of one of the cylinders. You do that, and now you have the center of mass, right? From that, we got a shift that is slightly less than 1 minus gamma times half the length of the thing. So it works perfectly fine with cylinders.
And you're coupling the cylinders through a common axis? Is that the idea? Is that how they're coupled together?
Yeah, just like the two halves of the hemisphere. So this should work for the cylinders just as well. I mean, you still have all of the same issue. The only thing you gain from it, rather than having to do a complicated integral, you just add two numbers instead of doing, you know, a couple of integrals. But I know you love doing those integrals, so I'm not going to tell you to stop it.
So what was the name of this experiment? Again, I'm looking for it here in the paper. I want to look that up.
Hayasaka Takeuchi.
Okay, I'll try to spell that.
H-A-Y-A-S-A-K-A-T-A-K-T-A-K-U-C-H-I. TakeUchi.
Okay, I got it. It's on page 19, right near the end. All right, I'll have to look that up and see what's going on. What were his arguments about that? Three factors?
Well, there were three things that happened in that, right? Basically, there was a linear change in weight rather than anything particularly interesting. The weight of the object was reduced by the rotation rather than increased. And the weight reduction differs with the direction of rotation in that thing. So clockwise and counterclockwise.
Yeah, and I remember hearing about this now. I'd always assumed that was experimental error. It didn't seem to make any sense that it would depend on the direction.
That's sort of what I assumed. But again, I assumed that this didn't go anywhere because this thing wasn't actually published, was it? I found it only in the archive and in what looked like somebody publishing two of his papers in a book. And I'm not sure if that was real or just somebody stealing the papers because they were public domain or something and publishing them.
Okay. Yeah, no, I haven't seen those papers or any articles on this.
On Amazon, you can buy the paper if you want to in a bound form, basically. It sounds like a good gig. Find the strangest things that nobody's willing to publish in a real journal and just put it on Amazon, yeah.
Put it on Amazon.
It works if it works.
Yeah, that's what I was intrigued by in this paper is that it seemed like it's reasonably within the realm of experimental possibility. I mean, instead of doing like a hemispherical shell, I think you should get the same effect with just a solid hemisphere. So you could tool a solid hemisphere with as part of its rotational shaft and use a centrifuge to spin it.
All he has to do is somehow make this thing spin. I mean, the issue is that you can't make the thing spin and have the other half spin, right? Because if you make the other half spin, it's going to get just as heavy. Assuming his analysis is correct, then you don't have whatever weird dipole effect you have, which, again, makes it a little bit worrying. But still, it has to be something outside, and you have to have two things connected to each other.
You'd only want to deal with a hemisphere. You wouldn't need the other half for anything.
But that does get me to one last thing, since he says that it gives you a gravitational dipole moment, but it doesn't seem to me that you have a unique dipole moment. And that's based on this whole analogy with electrodynamics, right? So if you have a monopole term, if you have a straight charge on an object, then that dipole term in the expansion of the potential, because you have a non-uniform charge density, that dipole term is not unique. It depends on where you're looking at the thing, what that dipole is. So that dipole term doesn't really mean anything if you have a leading term, a leading monopole term. And here, you will always have that monopole term, so that dipole term doesn't help you very much. So you don't really get a dipole thing just because you get a dipole term in your expansion. Because it's non-unique. It depends on your observation point.
I thought that it would depend on the rate of rotation.
It does depend on the rate of rotation. Two observers at different points in the same reference frame, two inertial observers going the same speed at different points in the universe, would disagree on the size of that dipole term.
I'm confused about that because this is a rotational dipole moment.
There's no rotation in the dipole moment. The dipole moment is purely due to that mass increase, that change in position of the center of mass.
Okay. And you're saying that that would be dependent on your state of motion?
Not your state of motion, your position in space.
Hmm.
So two people with the exact same motion, right? Two people that compared to this dual hemisphere object that has the dipole, those two people would disagree, even though they're not in relative motion to the dipole, based on their location in space.
Is there any way you could explain that to me?
That doesn't come from that. That actually just comes from the mathematics. Basically, there are things inside of that secondary term they're dependent on your position if the dipole term is not the leading term in the expansion. If the dipole term is the leading term in the expansion, then you do have a real dipole. But that means that you have to have something that has no net mass to have a unique dipole that everybody will agree is the same size.
So you'd need the exotic matter in order to make this thing.
Yeah, in the end, you'd need something exotic to make a real gravitational dipole.
That's interesting. That's a common theme among all of these gravitational field propulsions systems, is this need for negative matter.
This doesn't have to be the negative mass that we were just talking about. If you just have a negative gravitational charge, then you could end up with...
A true gravitational dipole moment. Well, I'm going to be putting my hopes on the antimatter experiments and hoping they'll come up with a negative gravitational charge because it would seem like it would throw the doors open to a lot of interesting things like this.
I'm sure there's a booking in Vegas that you can make that bet with.
Vegas. You're probably right.
Vegas is where the big scientific betting houses are. That's where everybody goes to bet on scientific experiments.
All right. Well, that leads us to Miguel Alcubierre's paper, which came out in 1994. That was, I guess, 2 years earlier. But everybody's heard a lot about this. And this also depends on this whole negative energy or negative mass energy to work.
So he has a fairly strange thing going on that I still don't understand. But yeah, at the end, he starts saying that violates all these cosmological rules. I'm not sure if that's very important, but basically this weak dominant and strong energy condition don't let you get this Alcubierre metric. But I think explaining what's going on there is the important thing, right? So I'm going to need you to walk me through this. So as I understand it, what he's saying is you're basically setting up some sort of energy condition. I don't know how you do this. Setting up this energy condition such that behind you, space is expanding, and in front of you, space is contracting. But not too close in either direction, because if it's too close, you're going to be torn apart into little tiny pieces. But still, it doesn't really matter too much about how close it is, because your idea is I want 100 light years away from here. So if I can find a way to travel most of that distance without it affecting anything in between, I'm happy. So basically, that's what I understand. And I mean, all the pictures of that sort of make it look a lot less weird than it, I think it really is.
When you look at the technical hurdles and some of the theoretical problems, it does get pretty hairy, but conceptually it's pretty simple.
I mean, conceptually it's simple, but in the diagrams, when they're looking at this, they always use pretty much the same 3D plot where, you know, they're showing, you know, radial distance perpendicular to your object in one direction. The other direction is the direction of travel. So you have direction of travel, the perpendicular direction, and then you have a Z-axis that they're plotting something against. And what they're plotting is the expansion of space-time. So behind it, it has a little peak, and in front of it, it has a trough. Because in front of the thing that you're trying to get to move along, you have to contract so that, you know, you're not pushing the thing that you want to get to away. That's why he has to have that contraction. And then in the middle, you have a place where your spaceship is or whatever. He's allowed to just move around without doing anything really particularly interesting, as long as he doesn't let the expansion part catch up with him or go too fast and hit that contraction part. So that spaceship is running along in that strange little bubble. It's not really a bubble, but sort of think of it like a bubble that's being pushed around in space. And as long as he can do that, and assuming that this little bubble can move really quickly, he can stay in there, even though the bubble, because it's apparently not a real thing, can move faster than the speed of light. He can move slower than the speed of light and get where he wants to go at the rate of speed of the bubble instead of the rate of speed of whatever his engines are.
That's right. Well, as a matter of fact, in Alcubierre's original paper, he was just thinking in terms of the spaceship being stationary with respect to his local space-time and the bubble doing all the work to propel him around. So he doesn't even feel any acceleration. He's in an inertial rest frame. And so he doesn't need any rocket engines or anything because the space distortion is doing all the work. And he was initially motivated by the theory of cosmic inflation, where the space-time metric expanded at much faster than the speed of light. And so he realized, well, you know, if there's a way to compress space-time in front of the craft and expand it at the same rate behind the craft, you could do that at any speed. So with this idea in theory, you should be able to turn on your field, feel absolutely nothing, but be propelled at huge accelerations, and you could make it to the nearest star and back in time for lunch, and you would never feel like you moved anywhere.
With some of the assumptions, some of the things that I'm not sure about, the big one I'm not sure about is that this deformation can propagate faster than the speed of light. But I mean, even given that, getting out of the bubble seems to be the problem that I'm most concerned with. So I can see you doing something like this, going past something that you want to take a quick peek at and coming back. I'm not sure if you can actually take the peek at the thing, but you can go past it and come back. But getting out of it is the problem, because every time I try to draw this, I keep getting into this problem that when you slow down, you have to re-expand all that contracted space. So you still haven't made any real progress, because after you re-expand all that contracted space, and you contract all that expanded space, why aren't you back at the spot where you started?
Let me think about that. I think the idea is basically like Robert Forward's idea of positive and negative matter interacting gravitationally. I think the idea is that, except he limits it to the shell region, where you've got a positive gravitational field in front of you and a negative gravitational field behind you. And so the rider is in the middle, and he rides that gradient forward, I guess, because it's coupled, I guess the front is coupled to the back so that the space is continually being contracted in the front and then expanding in the rear behind it. So it's kind of like almost like a hydrodynamic system, except using space-time.
So you're saying this is a little bit like what I originally thought it was, and not what I was getting from reading this, is that all of this space-time is basically flowing around.
Yes.
This little bubble.
Right. And so the spacecraft inside kind of gets moved forward almost like a conveyor belt.
I still don't really get it. I mean, I get that idea. It's just that when I try to picture these things in my head, or even on a piece of paper, I always see all this stuff catching up with the little guy somehow, with the spaceship somehow. So I'm not sure to what extent I can really be comfortable with this.
Yeah, it's a very weird idea because he's somehow confining a positive gravitational field in front without any like solid object. It's just a gravitational field with no mass in the middle. And how you establish this metric is still a mystery to everybody. Some people have had some ideas about that, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I think the idea is that the space-time is basically flowing around that bubble in the middle, so that it never interacts with the craft inside. Like if you had a little volume in front of the spacecraft, it would get compressed as the craft approached it, and then it would spread out around this spherical shell and then expand back into its normal size as it exited.
And when I start doing that, then I have to try to think about what does this look like in four dimensions? Because what this ends up looking like in four dimensions is a long tube. And I'm not really sure what that tube looks like, because when I think about that tube, so you have a tube of flat, normal, unperturbed, happy space-time inside of this weirdness going on with expansion and contraction. When I think about that, don't see how the thing is moving inside of that tube, unless he's actually moving, in which case, you know, something happens. I don't really get that again.
Yeah, I can't really visualize it that way either. When I think of it as a tube, like a three-dimensional tube, you can't see the compression and the expansion. You just see a tube.
Well, you can think about it in terms of like a color gradient or something like that. But still, I mean, the idea is to think about it a little bit like what is happening on this vertical axis. If the vertical axis, instead of just being this expansion or condensing of space, that vertical axis is time now. So you want to figure out, well, what's going on with this ship if that vertical axis is time? What is happening with that ship? Now, obviously, the shape of that tube is, you know, the cross-section of the tube going through space at an angle that's greater than 45 degrees from the time axis, because we want something that appears to go faster than the speed of light. But what that does to the thing inside, now that's the thing that's getting to me. If that thing is still in more or less the same reference frame that it when it started with, and this tube has to be tilted at that 45 degrees in space-time, then why is it moving along with the tube? Which is a little bit different from the expansion thing that I was thinking of just by reading the paper, right? The expansion thing where I'm reading the paper is you're taking one bit of space-time behind the thing and pushing it along. You're expanding that and contracting that other side, and that whole little part of space-time gets moved along. But like I said, in that case, to stop, you re-expand the contracted and contract the expanded parts, and you end up back where you started, which is no fun, right? So...
Right, it's like, I could see it was right in front of me, and then I turned off the field, and it was 4 light years away again.
So that's obviously not what is supposed to be going on here. But, you know, those are the only two things that I can visualize while going through the paper.
Yeah, I tend to look at it, I tend to prefer looking at it as like a, what they call a diamagnetic drive, which isn't an exact analogy, but it's a similar concept where if you have a gravitating body in front of you and an anti-gravitating body, a negative gravitating body behind you, then you'd get pushed along with them because you'd be constantly falling forward. So you'd be in free fall. You wouldn't feel anything. So you'd just be in free fall, but you'd be free falled in a preferred direction. That's a little easier for me to get my head around. And then I just kind of imagine that there's a flat space within that slope of space-time where you're just kind of riding on. And I think that's sort of what Miguel Alcubierre's idea is like, because you're still falling forward. But in his idea, your reference frame is like a bubble. But I don't think that's even really necessary. I mean, all you really need is a positive gravitational field in front of you and a negative one behind you. And then you've got a gravitational field propulsion system that will get you where you want to go. But you need to be able to turn on and off the gravitational fields. And all of the different objections to this tend to come down to the fact that there's no such thing as negative matter, so there's no such thing as negative gravitation. But then we see there's a dark energy effect, and that gives you some hope that, you know, maybe that there's some physical principle that we could harness to create this kind of effect where space-time expands, if we can figure out its mechanics. And then the other argument people make is that the Casimir effect shows you a region of very tiny negative energy density compared to the region outside the plates. There's an example of a very ineffectual, but nevertheless physically ponderable scenario where you have some negative energy.
Yeah, I mean, depending on what we're talking about and what we're calling negative energy and all that stuff, maybe it exists. But, I mean, the big question, assuming that all this stuff does what is claimed, one, can you have that kind of energy? And two, can you get enough of it? I mean, those are practical things. And assuming that this thing works the way Alcubierre says it works, the way this white guy seems to talk about it.
Harold White, yeah.
Well, I'm going to guess he's also a white guy. I'm not sure, though.
He is.
Okay.
Although Frank Black is a white guy, too, so you can't always be sure.
You know, assuming it works the way Alcubierre says it does, it's fine to talk about it and to think about what it means, even if this particular thing doesn't work out as something practical. Sort of like we were talking about Gödel and his very interesting metric, which had the closed time-like curves. Again, requires something that you probably will never see in the universe, but still, it tells you something about general relativity. So if you can understand this Alcubierre stuff, even if you can't make a warp drive from it, it tells you something about what's going on with general relativity and probably with inflation.
Yeah, that is it's an interesting question, you know, what drove the cosmic inflation epoch? You know, is there a particle? Is there, you know, what exactly was it that made the universe expand that rapidly? I mean, the geometric expansion in the early universe is a mind-boggling rate of increasing volume. So what made that happen, and can we harness that technologically, is a really interesting question. We can't even harness ordinary gravity right now. I mean, we can't create a gravitational field in front of a spacecraft. The only way we know how to make gravity right now is to have a bunch of matter all crewed together. These are huge theoretical questions that need to be answered, but it is intriguing that, at least within the theoretical constraints of general relativity, that there's nothing that prohibits it. It's a fascinating thing to see. It's really the only idea I've seen that's had any rigorous theoretical discussion that seems to offer the possibility for faster than light travel, even mathematically, right? So that's why I find it so interesting. You know, if you could produce an acceleration of 1g using some kind of field propulsion mechanism like this, or like any other idea, if you could do that, then you could circumnavigate the known universe in a human lifetime because of the time dilation effect. But here's an idea where you don't even have time dilation. You know, you could make it to the nearest star and be back in time for lunch, and the clocks on Earth would say, oh, you've only been gone for an hour.
That's the exciting thing here. I mean, it's not that you can get there, it's that you can come back.
And share your findings without everybody being extinct.
Okay. You've got something else you wanted to talk about a little bit?
Well, yeah, we had mentioned Harold White had done some work on this idea, and they're currently doing that right now at NASA, so I thought that'd be fun to talk about briefly. Is he published a paper called Warp Field Mechanics 101 back in 2011, and this was sort of a summary of all the work that he had done with Eric Davis and on his own over the intervening like decade before that, theoretically, exploring Alcubierre's idea, writing a canonical reformulation of the Alcubierre metric, programming that into a computer to optimize the energy requirements of the warp field, and then extrapolating the idea to a higher dimensional model of the universe. I think it has 8 dimensions, where, according to that model, you could create the dark energy effect using positive energy. And he figured out exactly how you would engineer such a thing if this higher dimensional model of the universe is accurate. And he found that if you had a ring of inductors and capacitors, that by charging the ring in a specific way, I think it's a high frequency field, that it would generate a spherical envelope, like a warp shell, akin to Alcubierre's idea. And then, so they've built this thing, and they've created the Jude White interferometer at the Johnson Space Center, and they're currently seeing if they can detect a tiny distortion in space-time using laser interferometer. So that work is ongoing right now. I think that it's highly speculative because it depends on an 8-dimensional universal model, but it is interesting that they took it from theory to an experimental prototype, and they're actually running experiments on it right now. I'm eager to see.
As far as the interferometry is concerned, this isn't anything particularly advanced, right? It's really just a Michelson interferometer with, in one leg, this toroid capacitor ring so that the beam passes through the center of this ring. Assuming that they've got all the right stuff going on, they should be able to find something. I think it would be amazing if they did, considering how simple the setup looked. Possibly it's just nobody's ever done anything like it, but it's still an extremely simple sort of interferometry setup.
Yeah, and I'm concerned because it's such a small device. I mean, it's about the size of your fist, and it can't be running that much energy through it. So they're trying to look for a space-time distortion effect with very little energy. It's hard to imagine that they could detect anything that way, but an interferometer can give you a pretty high resolution. The only thing that concerns me is that if that device works as advertised and it compresses space-time on one axial side of the ring and expands it on the other, then wouldn't it just negate its own length effect? They wouldn't even be able to measure it, would they?
I mean, if it's really contraction on one side and expansion on the other, then that's what you'd normally expect. And yeah, I think it would have to do that symmetrically. That's what I'd expect. Although, I mean, he did the numerical simulation, so assuming that the simulation is right, there shouldn't be any problem with that. It could just be, I mean, what you're just looking for is a small change in the time, so there could be just a small asymmetry that would do it.
Yeah, there was another factor that, some kind of top hat function in his work that I think is distinctive to that work that they're doing. And I think with that higher dimensional model where they're trying to create the Alcubierre effect, he's trying to create like a negative energy region within that spherical shell. So maybe that negative energy region should have an effect on like compressing space-time to make the distance a little bit smaller, the time passing through it a little bit smaller.
Possibly. Another thing is that Alcubierre said that this top hat function was a limit for his thing. I'm not surprised that you get the top hat function. So, I mean, the only issue is what exactly is going on. It might be that if you're actually traversing this highly warped space, right, now you're living with these nonlinearities, and those nonlinearities make all the difference for the traversal. Again, you know, you've got a small thing, it's fairly simple, it's got to be at reasonably low energy densities. Actually seeing the effect, even if all the analysis is correct, is still going to be fairly surprising.
Yeah, I'd feel a lot better if this device was like the size of an automobile and they were running, you know, several million amps through it and they had like a really highly precise laser interferometer working through it, you know, like the one they used for the LIGO experiment.
Yeah, but that's probably just because you've been watching too many episodes of Fringe, so.
Yeah, I have high ambitions for my Fringe physics.
Okay, well, any other thoughts on these things? I know you have a closing statement on this one, Randy.
Well, I just think that it's a fascinating area of inquiry, and I think that maybe we haven't had the breakthrough idea yet that we need to really start to bring gravitational field propulsion into the lab in a way that's really exciting and opens new doors. But I feel like it's one of those horizon physics concepts which is eventually going to clear over the horizon line, and I hope somebody can keep working on it creatively and come up with something that'll change the world, because our biggest problem with exploring space is the rocket principle and having to bring our fuel along with us as a reaction mass. And if we can find a way to use field energy to propel our spacecraft, then I think it'll change the world.
I'll leave you with that one, and thank you very much for talking with me this week.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your help.
All right, bye now.
Bye.
All goes back to that riddle that most people already know. And if you don't, I won't spoil it for you, which is the polar bear. I just spoiled it for you. But that's okay. Through the miracle of editing, I won't. And this will show up again at the end.